The plane touches down at Norman Manley International, or Toussaint Louverture. But there are no family members waiting with open arms at the gate. There is only the heat, the smell of jet fuel, and the heavy click of metal restraints being unlocked. For thousands of Caribbean men and women, this is the broken return. Since the mid-1990s, a shift in American law turned minor infractions into permanent exile, tearing at the fabric of the diaspora, from Brooklyn to Little Haiti. We often talk about the immigrant's dream of arrival, but we rarely speak of the nightmare of the forced return. It is a story of families split by 1,000 miles of ocean, and a legal system that no longer recognizes the nuance of a human life. This is our history of the modern exile, the story of those caught between a country that no longer wants them and a home they no longer know. Chapter 1. The Paperwork of Exile. The year 1996 changed the geography of our diaspora forever. It was not a hurricane or a war that shifted the ground, but a pen. When the United States passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, or IRRI, the rules of belonging were rewritten in an afternoon. Before this moment, a judge could look at a person. They could see a father, who had lived in Queens for 30 years. They could see a mother, who paid her taxes and raised 3 American children. If that person made a mistake, a minor drug charge, a scuffle, a shoplifting incident from a decade prior, the judge had the power to say, "This person belongs here." That power was deleted. The law became a machine. It created a category called the aggravated felony, a term that sounds like a violent headline but in practice could include a wide net of non-violent offenses. The law was applied backward in time. It did not matter if your mistake happened in 1982. In 1996, it became a ticking time bomb. Our people began to disappear from the barbershops in Dorchester and the markets in Flatbush. They were not being taken because they were new arrivals. They were being taken because they were established parts of the landscape. We must understand the precision of this trauma. When you remove a primary breadwinner from a household in the diaspora, you are not just removing one person. You are destabilizing a whole network of survival. The remittances that kept a grandmother in rural Jamaica fed and sheltered began to dry up. The children in Florida or New York suddenly found themselves in mixed-status households where the sound of a knock at the door carried a specific cold terror. We saw the rise of the criminal alien narrative, a linguistic trick that stripped our brothers and sisters of their humanity before they even reached a courtroom. The system was designed for efficiency, not for justice. It mandated detention. It stripped away the right to appeal. For the Jamaican who had forgotten the taste of a mango picked straight from the tree, or the Haitian who had fled the Duvalier years and built a life in the shadows of the American dream, the 1996 Act was a death sentence for their identity. They were told they were no longer Americans in spirit, even if they were Americans in every way but the paper. The paperwork of exile was being filed in triplicate, and the planes were fueling up. The law had become a wall that moved toward you. Chapter 2. The Flight to Nowhere. The transition from the holding cell to the tarmac is a blur of fluorescent lights and the heavy, rhythmic clinking of waist chains. This is the ICE Air experience. It is a fleet of chartered planes that move our history in reverse. On these flights, there are no vacationers. There are no excited children looking at the clouds. There is only a heavy, suffocating silence, broken by the occasional sob or the stern instructions of guards who are just doing a job. The passengers are dressed in gray or orange, their lives packed into a single plastic bag or left behind entirely in a rented apartment they will never see again. When the wheels touch down in Kingston, the heat of the island hits like a physical blow. It is a heat many haven't felt in 20 years. They are marched off the plane, often still in shackles, under the watchful eyes of local police. To the Jamaican authorities, these are not returning residents. They are involuntary returnees. They are processed in cramped rooms where the questions are cold and the future is a blank wall. Where will you stay? Do you have family here? For many, the answer is a hollow silence. Their parents are buried in New Jersey. Their siblings are in London. Their children are in high school in Atlanta. In Port-au-Prince, the arrival is even more jagged. The city is a cacophony of struggle, a place where the infrastructure is often a memory of better times. A deportee arriving in Haiti is often viewed with immediate suspicion. There is a stigma that clings to them like the dust of the road. They are seen as blanches who failed, people who went to the land of gold and returned with nothing but the clothes on their backs and a criminal record. They speak Creole with an accent, or they speak English with a desperation that no one in the market has time for. This is the moment the exile becomes real. It is the moment you realize that home is a place that has moved on without you. You are a ghost in your own country. You have the gait of a New Yorker and the slang of a Londoner, but you are standing in a gully in Kingston or a tent city in Haiti. The local landscape is beautiful, but it is a beauty that feels like an insult when you have no bed to sleep in. You are a citizen on paper, but a stranger in the streets. The survival skills learned in the Bronx do not translate to the informal economies of the Caribbean. The shackles come off, but the cage has simply grown larger. Chapter 3. The Shadow of the Returnee. The life of a deportee is lived in the shadow of a label. In Jamaica, the word itself is used as a slur, a way to mark someone as broken or dangerous. This stigma is a secondary wall. Even those who returned for minor, non-violent offenses find themselves shut out of the formal job market. Employers see the gap in the resume, they hear the foreign cadence in the voice, and they see the deportation papers. The returnee is forced into the margins, often gravitating toward the very criminal elements they were accused of belonging to in the North, simply because those are the only doors that remain open. But our history is also one of resistance and the refusal to be erased. In Haiti, movements like Alternative Chance or Chance Alternative emerged. These are self-help groups formed by returnees who realized that neither the American government nor the Haitian government was going to help them. They began to organize, to counsel one another, and to fight the perception that a deportee is a permanent predator. They are reclaiming the narrative, pointing out that they are often the victims of a transnational system that extracts labor and then discards the laborer when the politics shift. The cost of this exile is measured in the broken return of the family. We see grandmothers in the islands, suddenly tasked with caring for adult sons they haven't seen in decades, men who are suffering from the mental trauma of detention and the heartbreak of being separated from their own children. We see the transnational family become a fractured family. The video calls on WhatsApp are the only bridge left, a digital tether that keeps a father in Kingston connected to a daughter's graduation in Miami. It is a connection made of pixels and pain. The legacy of these broken returns is a Caribbean that is forced to absorb the failures of the American justice system. We are importing the consequences of a tough-on-crime era that happened thousands of miles away. As we look at our streets today, we must see the returnee not as a statistic of removal, but as a person in exile. They are the living evidence of a policy that chose the machine over the man. Their struggle to reintegrate is our collective struggle to define what it means to belong to a nation that was built on the movement of people. The plane departs empty, but the island is now heavy with the weight of those who were never meant to come back.